All right. How you doing, Rupert? Welcome to News of the Money World, everybody. Ready for another chat today?
Very ready. It's going to be a good chat today. We've got some amazing topics lined up. I'm quite excited.
Yeah. Well, let's hit the ground running with where we just left off before we hit record. New Zealand, we're kind of at this crossroads, no man's land, you could say, where we're in between phases in New Zealand. And I think this is probably tapping into a worldwide phenomenon where people are kind of looking back at the basics, right? Like, what do we need to make and do to get our country back on track? And great idea that you shared with me that you said wasn't your own. What about drones? So thinking about New Zealand as a manufacturing base, we do produce pretty cool stuff, like you were saying before. So do you want to just let everybody know what we were just talking about before? And what do you think could be a pathway for New Zealand to kind of get back on track with making and doing things?
Yeah. Look, it's kind of one of my current favorite conversations, right? New Zealand's got a massive productivity issue. We believe we're going to solve this productivity issue by copying low-tax countries like Singapore or Ireland, forgetting about the fact that Singapore, the kind of the hub in the center of Asia with English legal system, is why they're so successful. Doesn't really apply to New Zealand. Ireland, sitting on the outskirts of Europe, kind of going low-tax destination, cheap, easy access into Europe, doesn't really apply to New Zealand. But for some reason, those are the two countries that are held up on a pedestal is who we need to copy. So I've kind of been going, who's winning at the moment? And actually, the big winners over the last 10 years have actually been the manufacturers. And so is it about time that we're, and also the countries that are doing a big job in supporting some of their manufacturing industries, right? Let's be clear, the Inflation Reduction Act in the US, that was all about supporting domestic manufacturing, about kind of clean energy, a whole series of topics. China, well, we know what they're doing. That's just subsidization all over the place, and they kind of pick their winners and do other things. Europe, it's similar. Yet for some reason in New Zealand, we've taken the view that we can't manufacture. We're pretty bad at it. And therefore, we're kind of going, don't worry about it. We'll just outsource everything. There is no way that the government can help or do anything. So my very strong view is we go, actually, we need a manufacturing strategy in New Zealand. We need a strategy which says, actually, we are going to create industries. And that means that we're going to get our universities focused on R&D for these industries. Mm. We're going to focus on kind of making sure so we've got the right people. We're going to create resourcing legislation, so RMA, which enables us to actually support and fast track some of these kind of big factories and developments that are necessary. I mean, mining the West Coast, that's pretty hard, versus actually building a world-class pulp mill in the middle of the Waikato, that's a much better idea. So I think we need a complete rethink of how we're going to achieve growth and how we're going to achieve productivity. And then kind of finally, 3 minutes later, I'm answering your question. What do I think two of my ideas are? Well, one, which was not mine, which I'm going to start with the boring one first. First one is forestry, right? Like, we're a great exporter grower of logs. We're a great exporter of logs. But actually, how much of our university R&D time is spent going, how do we kind of make more value add? There are some great producers of high-end wood products in New Zealand, but they're small, they're niche, and they struggle because they're small-scale providers that actually can't afford to compete with the mega sawmills up in Asia where we export our raw logs to. So I go, actually, there's a great example of an industry where if we got right behind, we could grow, and all of a sudden, rather than manufacturing raw logs, which are kind of commodity and come and go with the cycles, we can start exporting high-end products. And you go, strategically for New Zealand, that makes sense, right? Another, the more controversial idea, strategically for New Zealand, high-end manufacturing, high-end drones. So New Zealand, very large country for its population base, right? Country the size of France, with a population 10%. We've also got one of the largest economic zones in the world because we managed to create this nice little 200-mile radius around any kind of thing that looks like an island. Sounds pretty China-esque when we describe it like that, but that's a separate topic. And we can't really monitor and maintain that because we've got no military and no navy. And even if we did, it would be an exorbitant cost anyway. And so then you come back to my little old New Zealand strategic piece and going, hold on a sec, we kind of need drones in New Zealand. We need to figure out how we rebuild our military because there is none at the moment. And I go, actually, there's a whole lot of sense. And we're actually already pretty good at high-end manufacturing because we've got these companies like Fisher Paykel Healthcare who make radiography machines and a whole lot of kind of super high-tech stuff. We've got countries like Raycon who are making semiconductor crystals, which is kind of at the upper end of kind of even above chips. we've got the likes of Rocket Lab making kind of rocket components. And I go, actually, maybe we're not as bad as we thought we are. But so I kind of go, how do we create this manufacturing base that's highly strategic and where we go? And I find that really interesting. The slight issue, and I'd be fascinated to see the reaction to this, is if we go into the drone speak. What happens, how do we support an industry as a country that ACC and NZ Super would not be allowed to invest in? Because they stay away from, they're not allowed to go into weapons, they're not allowed to go into arms. And let's be honest, if you're going to do this properly, it needs to be drones that are built for both military and civilian purposes. So that's my 3 minutes worth of New Zealand manufacturing strategy.
There you go. Hey, just follow that, New Zealand. We're all sweet. But I
it's very frustrating where you go, all we're doing is trying to copy other strategies from other countries and forgetting about us, right? We're forgetting about the fact that we do have needs in New Zealand. We do have some natural advantages and we're not the same as everyone else. So let's figure out what our advantages are. Let's figure out what we need and let's figure out how we can compete. I mean, this is the frustration with the government. This is corporate strategy 101. And why can't we apply corporate strategy 101 to government?
Well, if it's going to be applied, it'll be applied under this government would be my suggestion. But yeah, I haven't really heard a lot about that. It kind of makes sense. Yeah. Just watch the fastest Indian though, right? Like you realize that it's in our DNA in New Zealand now. That's probably been washed away. The number eight wire mentality, immigration will dilute that to a certain extent, or maybe it replaces it with a new type. We just haven't seen it yet, but that's a possibility.
But I'd challenge you on the immigration point, right? Because the amount of drive and innovation that's often required for people to make it to New Zealand is not insignificant, right? And so we need to be pretty clear on that. Yeah. I think we've actually gone too far down this track of saying it needs to be 100% free market. And I would argue we are one of the most freest markets and lowest regulatory markets and environments in the world, right? And I think we get ourselves into this trap of going, all we have to do is reduce regulation, get the government out of everything, don't let the government support anything. But kind of what that means is that we can't be strategic because the only person that can be strategic and control the direction of a broader economy, unfortunately, is the government. The flip side is they're incompetent. So whether they can do a good job of it is the issue.
Yeah. Well, there's probably like an ideological divide there that we would stand on opposite sides where I would say in the pursuit of our own self-interest, that's probably the best motivator rather than corporate centralized leadership because of the reasons what you alluded to, that there's probably some degree of incompetence or at worst malice behind those in the state.
Yeah, but without the government, though, how do you kind of, so forestry is a great example, right, where you go building a pulp mill, fuck, that's not easy, and you are going to need exemptions from Resource Management Act, and you are going to need stuff that's there.
Yeah,
drones, you need a whole lot of R&D, and actually forestry, you need a whole lot of R&D. There's a whole world which goes, and the problem is I think what we've found with the private sector taking the lead on all of these things over the last 40 years is that actually they're all out looking after their own interest and their own little tiny piece of the puzzle. And so therefore you need an entity sitting above it, which builds out the broader ecosystem. And that's what I'd love to see the government starting to do.
Yeah. I think like the only sort of caveat there is that when there's an existential threat of some sort, which is starting to brew in the form of World War III, that's when I think you start to see these individual self-interested groups actually getting into alignment. And so I think, to be honest, I think it's because we haven't had a mutual enemy for so long that we've looked to the state as the coordinator. And we've almost looked for things like DEI and ESG and all these woke ideologies as the almost like a religion in the state. And I think that there is a backlash that's growing against that. And I think that one of the people that I follow, actually, I might just read his post. One of the people that I follow who wrote a really cool post on this is Anthony Pompliano. And this guy, like avid Bitcoiner, really into business and into the startup, really, really good, hard, ethical worker. And so he put this post out this morning saying that there's a vibe shift underway. The vibe is shifting in America. Ideas like hard work, merit, and professionalism are making a strong comeback. Operating from a position of strength is always better than being weak. Don't let anyone fool you. Old school ethos have stood the test of time for a reason. And what I like about that post is that it seems to capture this sense that I think people, and this is primarily true in the United States, maybe less so in New Zealand, but we could be seeing the early stages of it. I think people are starting to resist this leftist, extreme leftist, woke ideology stuff where it's about being seen to be doing the right thing rather than actually doing the right thing. And I just wonder if that in any way is connected to what we were just talking about, in that there's going to be a shift towards maybe changing some of the restrictions that government has to stop the support. Like if NZ Super was able to invest in initiatives that were building drones to put us on the lease, well, that would actually immediately change things. But that comes because there would be an ideological shift higher up, right? So you can kind of see that there is an appetite for this change overseas. Whether it will hit New Zealand or not, it's a matter of debate. Thoughts on that?
Look, I think it's definitely coming, and I think it is here in New Zealand as well. I think the problem with that, my kind of coming back to my own Graylin philosophy, the problem with it though is let's tackle the real things versus tackling the ideas of things, right? And so sure. A good example of this is at the moment the debates that we have around housing and transport, right? The really easy answer for a lot of the right at the moment is just let it happen, let everything happen, and kind of people want cars, so let them have them and we'll just build roads, blah, 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 blah. The reality is we know that that's going to cause a whole series of problems and a whole series of issues. We know we can't afford the infrastructure. We know businesses like mine can't afford to kind of hire people, struggling to hire people in the inner city because actually it's too hard to get there because there's no public transport and rents are too expensive. There's this whole world, and I just think I agree that there's a whole, that we've kind of gone too far and we need to come back to some of the realities of life. But at the same time, that doesn't mean we go back to living in the 90s. The world has moved on and we need to kind of acknowledge that. And that's, I think, the frustration with some of the stuff that I see happening right here in New Zealand right now is a lot of the policies are basically assuming that life is no different to where we were in the 1970s, 1980s with a population of 1 million people, not 5.
Yeah. Okay. And I guess let's stay in the 80s, shall we? Let's stay there. Or even the late 70s, right? Let's talk about I was reading up on this morning. You fired through a really cool article around the Volcker shock. So Paul Volcker,
yep.
I think 1979 to 1982, somewhere around there, he was heading up the Fed. He was at the helm. They were increasing interest rates to deal with inflation, but came up with this idea that actually, no, it's not just about interest rates, it's about the supply of money. So they then worked on changing how the supply of money was growing. This will sound familiar to some people. And then it actually worked. They broke the back of inflation, but not without a severe recession that followed in the early 80s. But then what followed on from that was a 40-year period of prosperity, largely because of those falling interest rates taking the throttle off, perhaps. I think that the question that article posed was really interesting, which is, are interest rates actually inflationary? And I think if we look at this, I don't know if I brought this up with you, Rupert, in this podcast, but I've been thinking a lot lately about the concept that if we look at electricity, voltage, current, and inflation is a function of interest rates and the supply of money, just like power is a function of voltage and current. So if you increase one variable, interest rates, without decreasing the other one, you're still going to get inflation. And what we've kind of seen during this, I guess, the last 3 years is that there was talk of quantitative tightening, but actually it was just quantitative easing by another name through a lot of other backdoors of releasing new credit into the system. And interest rates have gone up, which should slow down the inflationary pressures, but the supply of money has actually been continually increased. And so in the late 70s, obviously that was dealt to. And then we had quite a severe pullback. And I just wonder if we're going to have to go back there again. Like, it feels like it's a little bit like the late 70s, but not a lot. And so I'd be keen to know what your views are around that. Like, if you think that we're going to head into this higher for longer regime, a lot of the banks here in New Zealand are talking about the opposite, that it's going to start coming down this year. I certainly hope that's true, but I'm always keen to kind of hear the other view.
I think we are in a higher for longer regime for the very simple reason that the governments are running humongous deficits. The US is running a deficit of 6-7% of GDP. That's 6-7% kind of extra demand in the economy than there previously was, right? The real culprit in all of this, in my mind, is government spending. I mean, look at New Zealand, right? New Zealand, we're running a deficit of 4% of GDP, and we've got another 4 or 5 years of it. And so, unfortunately, because of the way governments are spending and what they're doing, that means that that in its own right is actually likely to be inflationary. And so I think if we're, that's the big part that we haven't quite got our heads around is going, well, hold on a sec. If governments don't get under control and they don't take their kind of share of demand out of the economy, then fundamentally inflation is always going to be there and it's going to stay high. Central banks are actually going to believe that they need to stay, keep interest rates high to deal with it. But actually, it's, to me, it's more a political problem than a central bank problem. Because the other theory that's starting to come out that I kind of was reading about as well, which is fascinating, is that are higher interest rates inflationary in their own right? Mm. And the theory is kind of twofold, right? Number one is that when you're a corporate and you're paying higher interest rates, all of a sudden you need to bump up your prices to kind of earn a higher operating margin to afford that interest. And what do we see at the moment in listed companies in the US? They are operating at record high operating margins. Looking at some of the other things, right? The prevailing economic theory has always been that people do not spend interest and that they go that kind of interest, if you pay higher interest or it's saved, it's not actually spent. And that's largely due to the fact that it's wealthy people that earn the interest and then the poorer people generally don't. But I was doing a little bit of math on this and kind of thought it was really interesting, right? So these are US numbers because they're far easier to find. So private debt in the US is at about 150% of GDP. And so when we increase our interest rates, that means, so if interest rates go from 2% up to, or say where they were, so 2% kind of what people were paying up to 7%, 5%, that's actually a massive tax on the economy, right? So that's 6% kind of negative on GDP. However, actually the problem is it was all staggered. But then let's look at, and then the other big kind of provider of debt is the government. So the government, when they're sitting at another 100% of GDP, but let's be honest, they don't care. Their kind of spending keeps on going no matter what the interest rates are and what happens. But the other three lines that I found fascinating when I looked at all of this, right, as I said, they said, though, actually, bank deposits, that makes up 100% of GDP. So over the last 12 months, where the average bank deposit rate's gone from kind of 0.5% up to 5%, that's an extra 4.5% of income hitting people's pockets. You've got government bonds, right? They reckon about 30% of government bonds are owned by retail investors in the US. Again, that's higher income that's now flowing through. And so there's a very strong argument that actually, hold on a sec, by pushing interest rates up, we've pushed a whole lot more income into people and to people's pockets. And therefore, that's kind of what's driving a whole lot of this economic growth. And even when we think about the impact that this has all had over the last couple of years on the equity markets, where it's a widely acknowledged fact that when people feel richer, they spend more. Equity markets is kind of doing so well. It's been one of the big drivers for the economic growth over the last kind of little wee while because people feel wealthy. And so, yeah, so it's a fascinating kind of theory, right? And so, again, coming back to the 1970s, there was a strong argument, which was, hold on a sec, the higher interest rates, they actually fed on themselves and drove the first stages of inflation. And then it just takes a while for the economy to recalibrate, which is what brings it back down, right? And so, yeah, an interesting food for thought. Because no one's ever, the prevailing economic theory has always been higher interest rates, lower inflation, but it's never actually been empirically proven. And it's just been one of those hypotheses that no one's ever wanted to test.
Yeah. And it's made harder, I guess, in the sense that these numbers, effectively, they aren't included in CPI. And in theory, central banks are using CPI for the interest rate lever, in theory. And I guess their argument is that it creates feedback loops, which is true, but you got to answer the question as to why it's creating a feedback loop. And speaks to that question is the interest rates themselves are potentially the problem. And I think that I like it because if you think about it just as at a household level, you have some households in New Zealand, for example, that will have a lot of debt. And so interest rates go up, means there's less money available to spend out in the economy. And that in aggregate means that that whole band of people who have a lot of mortgage debt will be spending less in the real economy. But on the other side, maybe it's their parents, the baby boomers, that now have higher interest income. And the great news is it's far more consistent with a low risk investment strategy. You just leave your money in the savings account or term deposit or in bonds and just collect interest payments with relatively no risk, right? And so that segment of population maybe spends more, but they're not going to spend as much as the middle class. But then the other piece of this is like what you were saying before, I think is really important just around how this works when it feeds through, right? So if you were a business and you did borrow debt, so you're now not the middle class or the baby boomers, you're a business and you needed to borrow money to buy goods, then the increase or, you know, expand operations, plant and equipment, the increase to your costs, your interest costs going up means that you are going to pass that through in the form of higher prices for goods and services to a point, right? And then the people that are buying your goods and services will be able to pay those higher prices to a point. And then they'll stop buying it because their wages haven't increased at a fast enough rate to deal with that. So then you then have things like redundancies that pick up, which we're starting to see in New Zealand, at least anecdotally, massive increases in the last couple of weeks in terms of what I'm hearing with redundancies coming through. So I guess higher interest rates, they're a horrible, horrible tool in terms of controlling inflation. I think that's kind of what we're saying, right? They're not perfect. And like you say, there's not necessarily the empirical research out there that can actually support that high interest rates actually do deal with inflation. Yet that's still what we're told anyway, central banks are still doing. It's interesting, eh?
So Don Brash was quite interesting on this. When he was governor of the Reserve Bank, he said the two things that he would like to do to control inflation, petrol taxes, variable petrol taxes, and variable GST. Because if you go, actually, I want to impact spending across the entire economy immediately, that's what does it, right? And then you don't have the income side on the other thing, on the other part of it. I mean, and that, I guess, aligns with the modern monetary theory, which is basically governments shouldn't really care about debt. So if they've got to drop petrol taxes to kind of stimulate the economy, is that actually a much better way of doing it than forking out large on a whole series of or drop GST? Is that actually a much better way of doing it than forking out large on a massive set of dud infrastructure projects that probably get cancelled the moment the next government comes in?
Yeah. Well, the key word you said, though, variable, right? And I think that's where we will be. This is kind of like how central banks really need to sell central bank issued digital currencies or programmable money, is that whole variable tax. If you can control the purchasing power of our dollars specific to what we're spending money on, you can more accurately control where money is flowing within the economy. And therefore, you can kind of see why there's a real incentive for them to roll that technology out. Hey, because let's talk about this. Sorry, go ahead. No, you're going to say something.
I was just going to one final thought, because what's fascinating is, the articles that are on it saying, no one knows why we chose 2%. It was a little country in the South Pacific that decided to kind of choose inflation targeting as the main tool for interest rates. There's a whole theory that actually, the more I think about it, it's all been on this hypothesis that it might have worked, but there's not much underlying theory behind it.
No, no. We need less marketing people in central banks and more researchers, in my view, to actually come up with some actual new innovative ways to deal with an economy that's evolving. You can't control a changing dynamic system with a stagnant ideology or economic paradigm like neoclassical economics. It doesn't work like that. You have to constantly update your operating system. So let's talk about the orange elephant in the room. And it seems almost disrespectful to talk to him, talk to him about the orange man here, Donald Trump, after what happened over the weekend with this assassination attempt, or if you read mainstream media, an incident or a fall or loud noises. But no, it was an assassination attempt. And it either happened because of gross negligence by the Secret Service, or even worse, some sort of intended assassination attempt from those darker forces that lurk behind the people that we see all the time. So with the correlation to Bitcoin is what I was really interested in. And just seeing how the logic moved so fast in markets. So we had this assassination attempt, saw that it was just his ear. He was all right. As soon as the coast was clear and his fist was up in rage, it immediately transitioned to Trump good for Bitcoin and crypto, Biden bad, Trump might get in, Bitcoin price go up. And it was phenomenal. And it made me wonder just what other asset classes or what other investments would be favorable in an environment where Trump was elected. I'd be keen to hear your thoughts.
Well, I think there's a pretty universal view that Trump should be good for the markets, very good for fossil fuels, and very good for American manufacturing, right? Because the three tenets of his core industrial policy are massive tariffs on China and America first and America manufacturing. That's number one. Number two is he wants to make it much easier to drill and mine and do all of that good stuff to get as many of the natural resources out as fast as he can. So he wants all subsidies scrapped for anything in the clean energy space. And number three, he wants lower taxes. And so the tax cuts that he brought in, I think, are about to expire, or they have expired, I can't remember, but he will kind of reinstate them, and even he's talking about going even further. From a listed company perspective, it's actually pretty good, right? When you put all that together, you have strong manufacturing, strong fossil fuels, and lower taxes. And so that's why US equities have done pretty well, and they've done pretty well over the last couple of days. Not so good if you're a European car maker who manufactures in Europe. Not so good if you're a Chinese car manufacturer. And so I think there will be some winners and losers out of this, but pretty clearly this America first strategy is pretty good. The other thing that I find fascinating, and I suspect is part of this and kind of what we've seen in the markets over the last couple of days, is he is becoming, if anything, the crypto story is kind of concerning to me personally, because what's happened is he's gone 2019 as someone who hated crypto, thought it was all for drug dealers, money laundering, and all of that kind of stuff. Reputedly, his mind has been changed by the fact that a whole lot of crypto, wealthy crypto guys have now gotten behind his campaign, running fundraisers for him, expensive events at Mar-a-Lago. This whole world of kind of, and we talk about it a lot, or we don't talk about it, but it is talked about a lot, is the American lobbying machine. Yeah. And it feels as though the American lobbying machine, the crypto world, has got their hands on Trump, and they're just going all in here. And it looks to be working. And that's why, I mean, the Bitcoin price shot up on the day, because the probability of him becoming elected just kind of significantly grew again. And so I do start to wonder, what are some of the other industries that are going to be able to do this over the next 3 to 6 months as well, right? Because there will be a lot of other industries going, shit, well, look what we can do, actually. And he probably is a bit more pliable than they had initially thought. But the big question being, will he actually do what he says he's going to do?
Yeah, totally. And that is exactly like that, echoing the concerns of a lot of people that I follow in the crypto space anyway, is the politicians. You can't trust any of them from the left or the right. So don't put your faith too much in politicians. But it feels like a lot of people that are very bullish on crypto are putting their faith in politicians. But it was just quite fascinating, though, that one event, that failed assassination attempt, seemed to be like a key tipping point where now we have critical force behind this. Now, the machine of political donations has really kicked into high gear, where people realize, actually, he's probably going to get in. It's kind of like, I think, early stage conviction building. And so people are now more willing to put money in behind these things because they have a chance that money is going to be a good investment to get their initiatives through. But things can change on a dime, right? I find it fascinating, though, just how the technicals and the fundamentals seem to be lined up, because the Bitcoin price in particular was kind of going through an interesting technical pattern on the charts right as this failed assassination attempt kicked in. And it's just weird how this often happens. Pick a market, any market, it seems like you read the tea leaves and it kind of predicts the future, like when something would happen that could make it go either way. And we are kind of typically seeing a bit of a bull run, bit of a retracement, and then it builds from there in our 4-year cycle with Bitcoin summer, as they say, and we're kind of on track. And so maybe this is continuation. Maybe it's going to keep on building from here. ETF fund inflows picking up. There's more crypto ETFs being approved from over the world. It does look bullish for crypto, to be honest, and there's more liquidity sloshing around the global economy. So regardless of what interest rates are doing, it's about the flow of money. So I can kind of see that things are looking good there. But again, financial advice, just in case we haven't said it today, right?
Yeah. Oh, look, I hope you're right. I really do. I think probably my bigger fear is, I think there's a lot of positive things. There are a few cloud storms floating around at the moment. And we know crypto and Bitcoin, it is a risk on asset. And so it wouldn't take much for that risk sentiment to shift pretty quickly. And before we know it, we're seeing $30,000 again. The question is, well, but that, to be fair though, that's not a bad thing. It's just a fact of being a crypto investor, right? And that's like, we know what this is going to happen, right? If it was a smooth line, it'd be great, but it's not.
Well, everyone would do it,
a sorted line, and let's just hope that it keeps going up.
Yeah. Everybody would do it if it was a smooth line up and to the right.
Well, exactly.
And everybody thinks they can handle the volatility and they want the high growth option. But then when the volatility hits, they realize, actually, no, they're not made up of the DNA required to hang on when things are scary. Just look at the property market with mom and dad property investors dumping at the trough of the market, really. And I think that speaks, like you'd see that happen faster in the crypto market because it's such a volatile space. But if you are a long-term investor, you should be looking at the trends that are going to be real in the long term, not the near term.
Yeah. And to be fair, one of the, well, I know, actually, I'd say it, there's a lot of the trends driving the some of the crypto big sell downs and no different to that that we're seeing by mum and dad property investors. And that's as simple as leverage. A lot of the crypto stuff is bought with leverage. And unfortunately, that's why a lot of those mum and dad investors are having to sell because they can't afford the interest payments. And,
Always a good chat, Rupert. Thank you for your chat today. I've learned a few things. I love your perspectives on all these things and the different color that you bring to these matters. So yeah, cool chat. we'll catch up next week. All going well.
Awesome. Well, thanks, Darcy. And we'll speak next week.